go on to look over that ship that crashed. Now do what you can to lead us to Statata and Kihith. We want to comb this island clean before the storm passes. Toshio nodded. Yes, sir. I should be able to stumble around that long. I don't suppose anyone's found Hist. No, we're worried about that, but nowhere near as worried as when Brukita came back alone. Kipiru's told us most of the story. That Finn thinks rather highly of you, you know. You did quite a job here. Toshio turned away, as if ashamed to receive the praise. Orly looked at him curiously. He had never given much thought to the Midi. During the first part of the voyage, the youth had seemed bright, but a bit irresponsible. Later, after they found the derelict fleet, he had turned morose, as their chances of ever going home diminished. Now there was this new note. It was too soon to tell the long-term effects, but this had clearly been a rite of passage for Toshio. Humming sounds drifted up from the beach. Soon two spider-like mechanicals strode into view, a hammocked and harnessed dolphin piloting each one. Toshio sighed a little raggedly as Orly helped him stand. Then the older man stooped to pick up an object from the ground. He hefted it in his left hand. A scraper, isn't it? Made from bits of metal fish spine glued to a wood handle. I guess so. Do they have much of a language yet? No, sir. Well, the rudiments. They seem to be stabilized. Strict hunter-gatherers. Hikahi guesses they've been stuck for 500,000 years. Orly nodded. This native species looked right at first glance, a pre-sentient race at just the right stage for uplift. It was a miracle some galactic patron line hadn't snapped them up already, for client status and an eon of servitude. Now the men and fen of Streaker had yet another obligation, and secrecy was more important than ever. He put the artifact in his pocket, then laid his hand on Toshio's shoulder. Well, you can tell us all about it back on the ship, son. In the meantime, you have some pondering to do. Sir? Toshio looked up in confusion. Well, it isn't everybody who gets to name a future space-faring race. You know, the Fen will be expecting you to make up a song about it. Toshio looked at the older man, uncertain if he was joking. But Thomas Orly had on his usual enigmatic expression. Orly glanced up at the rain clouds. As the mechanicals moved in to claim Hikahi, he stepped back and smiled at the curtain, which temporarily hung across the theater of the sky. Part 2. Currents. For the sky and the sea, and the sea and the sky, lay like a load on my weary eye, and the dead lay at my feet. S.T. Coleridge. Chapter 14. Denny. Charles Dart pulled away from the polarization microscope and growled an oath. In a habit he had spent half his life trying to break, he absently laid his forearms over his head and tugged on his hairy ears. It was a simian contortion no one else aboard ship could easily duplicate. Had he noticed he was doing it, he would have quit instantly. Of a crew of 150, only 8 aboard the Streaker even had arms or external ears. One of these shared the dry lab with him. Commenting on Charles Dart's body behaviors did not occur to Denny Sudman. He had long ceased to notice such things as his loose, rolling gait, his shrieking chimpanzee laughter, or the sparse fur that nearly covered his body. "What is it?" she asked. "Are you still having trouble with those core samples?" Dart nodded absently, staring at the screen. "Yeah." His voice was low and scratchy. At his best, Charles Dart sounded like a man speaking with gravel in his throat. Sometimes, when he had something complicated to say, he unconsciously moved his hands in the sign language of his youth.
"I can't make any sense out of these isotope concentrations," he growled. "And there are minerals in all the wrong places. Siderophiles without metals. Intricate crystals at a depth where there shouldn't be such complexity. Captain Krydike's silly restrictions are crippling my work. I wish he'd let me do some seismic scans and deep radar."
He swiveled about in his seat to look at Denny earnestly, as if hoping she would concur. Denny's smile was broad under high cheekbones, her almond eyes narrowed in amusement.
"Sure, Charlie, why not? Here we are in a crippled ship, hidden under an ocean on a deadly world, with fleets from a dozen arrogant and powerful patron lines fighting over the right to capture us, and you want to start setting off explosions and casting gravity beams around? Wonderful idea. Say, I've got an even better one. Why don't we just take out a large sign and wave it at the sky, something that says, 'Yoo-hoo, beasties, come and eat us.' Hmm?"
Charlie cast a sidelong look at her, one of his rare, unhinged, lopsided grins.
"Oh, they wouldn't have to be big gravity scans, and I'd only need a few teeny-tiny explosions for seismography. The ETs wouldn't notice those, you think?"
Denny laughed. What Charlie wanted was to make the planet ring like a bell, so he could trace the patterns of seismic waves in the interior. Teeny-tiny explosions, indeed. More likely detonations in the kiloton range. Sometimes Charlie seemed so single-minded a planetologist that it bothered Denny. This time, however, she was obviously having some fun at his expense. He laughed as well, letting out brief whoops that echoed off the stark white walls of the dry lab. He thumped the table beside him. Grinning, Denny filled a zip case with papers.
"You know, Charlie, there are volcanoes going off all the time, a few degrees away from here. If you're lucky, one might start right near us."
Charlie looked hopeful.
"Gee, you think so?"
"Sure. And if the ETs start bombing the planet to get at us, you'll have plenty of data from all the near misses. That is, if they don't bomb so hard as to make geophysical analyses of Kithrop moot. I envy you your potential silver lining. In the meantime, I intend to forget about my own frustrating research and go get some lunch. Coming?"
"Nah, thanks, though. I brought my own. I think I'll stay and work for a while."
"Suit yourself. Still, you might try to see more of the ship other than your quarters and this lab."
"I talk to Metz and Brukita all the time on screen. I don't need to wander around gawking at this Rube Goldberg contraption that can't even fly anymore."
"And besides," she prompted. Charlie grinned.
"And besides, I hate getting wet. I still think you humans should have worked on dogs second after casting your spells on us pan-types. Dolphins are all right. Some of my best friends are Finns. But they were a funny bunch to try to make into a space-traveling race."
He shook his head with an expression of sad wisdom. Obviously, he thought the whole uplift process on Earth would have been better handled had his people been in charge.
"Well, they're superb space pilots, for one thing," Denny suggested. "Look at how hot a star jockey Kipiru is."
"Yeah, and look at what a jerk-off that Finn can be when he's not piloting. Honestly, Denny, this trip has made me wonder if Finns are really ready for spaceflight. Have you seen how some of them have been acting since we got into trouble? All the pressure is making some of them unravel, especially some of Metz's big Stenos."
"You're not being charitable," Denny chided. "Nobody ever expected this mission to be so stressful. I think most of the Fen are doing marvelously. Look at how Krydike slipped us away from that trap at Mordrin."
Charlie shook his head.
"I don't know. I still wish there were more men and chimps aboard.
1 century. That's how much longer than dolphins, chimps had been a recognized space-faring species. Denny figured 1 million years from now they would still hold a patronizing attitude over that lead.
Well, if you're not coming, I'm off.
Denny took her notecase and touched the palm plate by the door. See you, Charlie. The chimp called after her before the door hissed shut.
By the way, if you run into Takat or Sao, have them call me, eh? I'm thinking these subduction anomalies may be paleotechnic. An archaeologist may be interested.
Denny let the door close without answering. If she didn't acknowledge Charlie's request, she could feign ignorance later. There was no way she would go out of her way to speak to Sao, whatever the significance of Charlie's find. Avoiding that particular dolphin was already taking up too much of her time.
This ends side 2 of cassette 2.